The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Standard ways of talking about the heart of Buddhism, or the central element of Buddhism, is the Eightfold Path. And one of the nice things about, or one of the aspects of this Eightfold Path, is this is a part of Buddhism that's practical, that involves engaging ourselves, being engaged personally, being involved personally. It's very easy to read books about Buddhism, and there are some very abstract books about Buddhist philosophy that you can nod and agree with or not agree with or be confused by, but it kind of keeps you in your head, in the mind, in idea, world of ideas. And you know, in terms of Buddhism, the point of Buddhism is not to stay in our head, not to stay in ideas, but to be able to drop down into the immediacy of our life and how we live our life and how we engage with our life, and in order to make our life, turn our life into our practice arena. As I like to say, to tell some people, for lay people like us who don't live in monasteries, the Eightfold Path is the way to make our life our monastery. And the idea that this is how to inhabit our life in such a way, enter our life, so that the elements of our life can be supportive and a part of the Buddhist practice. So it's called a path because it's partly because it's something we walk and we engage in. And you know, when you walk on a path, you bring all of yourself along. You don't leave your arms behind or your head behind, or you know, you kind of bring all along. And so it's something you fully include. A path also has the implication, the idea that there's a destination, maybe some place you're going. And in fact, in the time of the Buddha, in his teachings, there's a very clear idea of where this path goes. And the path goes to, you know, liberation, to enlightenment. These are big terms, great ideals, and that sometimes can seem kind of mystical or strange or imply some kind of big bang theory of spirituality. Just get that enlightenment and you'll be happy ever after. Or some idea of some wonderful Disneyland of great spiritual experiences. The goal of the Buddha, in using the word liberation, is the liberation from suffering, which is the immediate experience that all of us can have of both mild suffering and some of the great sufferings that can experience in life. And to somehow to have a path that addresses that. And supposedly it's meant to address it directly so that we can become free of that suffering. So we don't have to walk around with the kind of stress that our system has to carry if we are suffering. Suffering is quite stressful to have. And it's one of the remarkable things that the Buddha offers a path to happiness, a path to freedom from suffering, that, you know, religious path, in the sense that it, religious perhaps in the sense that it involves ultimate meaning, the ultimate value of our life. And the Buddha does this without any recourse to the supernatural. There's no recourse to gods, no recourse to something, some tenets or beliefs that you can't verify for yourself. But actually, he presents it in something that you can verify in your own experience quite easily, I think. And so closely connected to the Eightfold Path and contained within it is the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths is this teaching that when you have suffering, there's a cause to that suffering, and that cause is found in something in you, which is your craving, your thirst, your clinging. And you don't suffer, but the Buddhist analysis is you don't suffer unless you yourself participate in that suffering by contributing clinging or craving. In that it's your contribution, you can stop contributing. And so you stop contributing by what's called the cessation of clinging. And that cessation of clinging involves the cessation of suffering. And then the fourth noble truth is that because it's not easy just to end your clinging, there is the Eightfold Path. So those four, those steps, is something I think you all have experience with. It's not something mystical and strange that you don't already know. I'm pretty confident that all of you, in your way, if you kind of think about it, apply this to your situation, have been in situations where you found that you were overly engaged in the situation with too much desire or too much tightening or subset, and you felt, you know, I think this, and feeling this hurts, this is painful, stressful, and realizing, you know, I'd better stop this behavior of wanting this so much. And so you let go, if you can let go. Or if you can't let go easily, then you kind of figure out what you can do that helps you let go. And it could be something as simple as what happens to you in the checkout counter in the supermarket. There's a long line, you chose the wrong line to stand in, and you might even go to a different line, but it turns out that now this is the wrong line, the first one is going faster. And so you feel your impatience, you start getting tight and tense, and you start kind of questioning the efficacy or efficiency of the checkout clerk, and you know, and you kind of feel yourself tightening up and tensing and your mind's racing. And after a while you notice that this is stressful to be under, and you look around and you realize you can't really do anything. You're there, you have to kind of go through the line. And you realize that, you know, nothing really doesn't help anything to kind of be tense about getting through. And so you realize, I should cool it. I should not be so eager or so desperate to get through the line. And so perhaps you relax. Or perhaps you can't relax and you realize, I need help. I need a path to help me relax here in the checkout counter. I think maybe I'll try breathing deeply. And so you breathe deeply, perhaps, and that breathing deeply somehow gets you to relax your body, and some of that stress of wanting to get out quickly has dissipated. So I don't know if that was the best choice of an example, but what I'm hoping is that with that kind of example, you can also spend some time thinking about all the different places in your life that you already know the Four Noble Truths. They're not strange topics. They're not something that's, you know, mystical or supernatural or something foreign. You're actually already doing it. And in that you're already doing it, maybe you have a different formulation of how that works, but basically you already do it. What the Buddha was saying, you could do this probably a lot better than you already are. You can apply this in a stronger and deeper way or more full way and to address some of the deepest forms of suffering that you have in your life. And so what people have found over since the time of the Buddha is that the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path applies at many different levels of a person's life. It applies at checkout counter. It applies at work. It applies in our interpersonal life. It applies at home. It applies in, you know, many different situations. But it also applies in what I think could be called the spiritual or existential dimensions of our life. And so for people who, there are some people who see that the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, represent the ultimate meaning, ultimate purpose of their life. It's integrated in the fullness of all aspects of their life. It provides an integrated, complete path of life. And so much so that we call it here in the West a religious perspective, a spiritual path. And the people who then take it for full potential of this ordinary thing, of the Four Noble Truths, are said to become people who are enlightened, become realized, become liberated. And it's quite remarkable to have an experience of the mind, the heart, liberated from any kind of stress whatsoever, any kind of clinging and desire. For some people, then, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths together, are tremendously joyful. It brings a lot of joy. The Buddha talked about the joy of the Eightfold Path because it gives a life a sense of purpose. It gives it a meaning. It gives it a definition, so you know what your life is about. There's a lot of things to do in life. There's so many things that sometimes people are confused of what to do. But for the people who have the certainty about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, their life is, in a certain kind of healthy way, defined, or and so even though you might still have to make decisions about what kind of work to have and where to live and any job to have or whatever, the core, the ballast of the life, the sense of purpose and meaning, has to do with getting through the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path in a meaningful way. The Buddha talked about these, the Eightfold Path, as being the most reliable refuge you can have. Many Buddhists will say the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha is their refuge, which is very meaningful for people. But it's a refuge in the sense that it's a support for us to apply the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, in all the different areas of our life. It can be challenging to do this. Some people will find it that's the most challenging thing of their life, to really take the Four Noble Truths seriously and let it really drop down into the depth of their life, to the deepest existential places where we're of clinging and holding. The very sense we have of being a self, the core identities we carry about who we are not innocent in the sense that they're just there casually and lightly and, you know, we'll take it or leave it. But there's often a tremendous amount of clinging and holding to identity, to a sense of self. There's often a tremendous amount of clinging to what we want or what we don't want. Some people feel that life is insecure. They feel not safe. They feel that it doesn't have any stability in this world. And so they, in order to find an orientation, find a stability, they cling and hold on to things. Some people cling and hold on to relationships, some people to status, some people to jobs, some people to homes, some people to bank accounts, some people to religion. It's a very popular thing to cling to, including Buddhism. It's kind of a paradox, right? You're clinging to the teaching that teaches you not to cling. So, you know, so eventually it works. Some people cling to, certainly to identities. They cling to being someone. Some people occasionally cling to their suffering because the suffering is familiar and it gives them some sense of purpose and orientation and place in the world. And so suffering is very important to hold on to. But the Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path as a refuge, as a place of support, not as a place to escape the world, like a refuge place to go, but rather as an understanding and an orientation that provides safety wherever we go. It's the portable refuge, it's the portable safety. And the primary thing it protects us from is ourselves. Rather than, you know, the world around us. Because the greatest danger for our heart is what we do inside of ourselves. There's a great teaching of the Buddha gave, practical wisdom. And it goes something like this. If you get angry at your enemy, you're doing your enemy a favor. I think it goes a little bit more than that. You're doing your enemy a favor in harming yourself in the ways your enemy couldn't. So your enemy might want to harm you, but your enemy can't get into your heart, your metaphorical heart, unless you react in such a way. If you get angry or you get closed down or do something, you're responsible for what your heart does, not your enemy. And so there's a certain domain of our inner life that people can only get into and cause harm if we somehow receive it and do something with what happens to that, what people do. So one of the core aspects of this Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths is taking responsibility for ourselves. And some people don't want to be involved in Buddhist practice because of the way in which it requires, if you're interested in this path, it requires taking responsibility for yourself and doing this. And, you know, some people feel even, will protest. The spiritual tradition, we have to take responsibility. I mean, the whole point of a religion for some people is to have someone else take responsibility. And, you know, and then it seems maybe it's selfish or maybe it's, you know, it's a lot of work. But, you know, if you're going to learn a foreign language, You're not expecting someone else to learn for you. If you're going to learn to swim, if you don't know how to swim, you have to take responsibility for learning yourself. You don't just kind of, you know, read a book and then, you know, carry the book around saying, I have the truth and now I'm going to swim. We have to take, there's a lot of places in life where we have to take responsibility. And so for our deepest inner places in our hearts, our inner life, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are ways of taking responsibility for ourselves. And so the Buddha called that a refuge, a support, a place of safety. And I don't underestimate how powerful and meaningful it is to be protected from yourself. To be protected from yourself so that you don't cling, so that you don't tighten up, you don't end up living in fear, that greed and hate become a problem. It's impressive to me. I've been teaching now and here in this valley for, you know, over 20 years. And I have more people coming and talking to me now about addiction problems than I had in the 1990s. I don't know if, you know, maybe people are talking to me now about it the way they didn't. But all kinds. And one of the ones that's really escalated a lot, I mean, I'm sure it was there in the 90s, but no one talked to me about it. But now they talk to me because people are really troubled, is pornography. I think maybe because of the internet. And there was someone who told me just last week about how, night after night, staying up until 2 o'clock at night, and then getting 2 hours of sleep or something, and then going to work, and just the challenges of this and what was going on. So, you know, that's not being protected from yourself. You know, so people are doing these things to themselves. So is there a path to freedom? The Eightfold Path, the Buddha called a middle way, the middle way. And it was meant to be the middle way between sensual indulgence, staying up until middle of the night, watching the internet, and self-mortification, ascetic practice, and harming yourself intentionally. Because back in ancient India, those were seen as two extremes, the people who pursued sensual pleasure to an extreme, and the people who pursued ascetic practices, self-mortification practice. And the middle way is supposed to be the middle way between those. And I think it's a beautiful middle way because you're not supposed to deprive yourself, but you're not supposed to indulge yourself. You're not supposed to live a life of hardship when you follow the Buddhist path, but you're not supposed to have a life that's taking more than you need. Part of the middle way and part of the Eightfold Path is a life of contentment. And it's exemplified in the life of the Buddhist monastic. I think compared to the lifestyle of many of us here, a Buddhist monastic lifestyle is one of great renunciation. But especially, I think, in ancient India, but I think still today, the Buddhist monastic life was designed for a person to have just enough to be comfortable with not an iota more. Just enough clothes so that they were clothed properly, just enough food so they can be fed fine, just enough shelter so that they're protected from the elements, just enough medicine so that they can be cured if there's an illness. What else do you need? You know, just enough so they're comfortable. So they're not supposed to be ascetic and, you know, emaciated, but enough to be comfortable. So how this translates to us here, the middle way, is that the middle way perhaps is doesn't require us, no essential requirement to become renunciants, to deny ourselves in some heavy negative way. But it also is not meant to be some way to indulge ourselves. And how we negotiate this world of not indulging but not harming is a very interesting approach to life. But not because indulging and harming ourselves are wrong, but because both those things cause suffering. And if we want to become free of suffering, then we have to really take a look at how we live our lives, and can we find a way of living our lives that supports the process of relaxing, releasing, opening up that the Eightfold Path entails. So the Eightfold Path is meant to include our whole life, and so I don't know if you feel it all fits in there, but I have my theories about if the Buddha lived today, what would be the ninth path, or the Ninefold Path, and maybe the tenth even, but you know, maybe it was a simpler life back, the different life, so eight was enough. So it begins with what's called right view. Right view is that works really well for a translation for the Indian Buddhist word, ditti. It has the same kind of double meaning in English, a view, a belief or understanding, an idea, and a way of seeing. So it begins with a way of seeing, and I like to think of it as an orientation. It's the orientation we have for how to find our way through life. It's the orientation we have so we find the path. And the Eightfold Path is a path. And this metaphor of path is very meaningful for me, because when I look at the Buddhist path, I see a wide and straight and clean path in front of me. When I look at the world and how we're going to live in the world, it's crooked. You know, it's all kinds of things. But the Eightfold Path doesn't exist except in the mind's eye, or the wisdom eye, or the Dharma eye that we have. And if we use that wisdom eye, the inner light, to see, I see, in a sense, a path that goes straight ahead, very clear, very clean, very open for us to walk, incomparable to anything else. So it begins by finding that path, the right view, right orientation. And then with that view of a path, the possibility of becoming free of suffering, it continues with right, what's called the right intention. To have the right sense of purpose or aspiration, or right motivation, a right way of thinking about what we're going to do. And the simplest way of talking about this that's, I think, meaningful in a direct way for many people is that it helps. The right intention is not to indulge in sensual pleasure. And the operating word is indulge. Don't stay up until 2 o'clock at night on the internet. Cultivate loving kindness, goodwill, cultivate goodwill, and cultivate compassion. Or have that as an orientation, the intention for your life. And it's a beautiful thing. And those three, especially the last two of goodwill and compassion, includes the world around us and people around us, because goodwill and compassion is interpersonal. So the right view, the first one, is the orientation that I'm going to free myself from suffering. There's the Four Noble Truths. There's an orientation to find where suffering is, the cause, the end of it. That's the orientation. That's the door to the path, the entrance to the path. In a sense, that's personal. The next step has a lot to do with the interpersonal world we live in. It's very important how we live in our society, in our communities. Unless we somehow take care of our communities, our relationship to communities, you're not going to find the path. And so beginning to have some interest in approaching the world with goodwill and compassion is a really important part of this. And then, if you're interested in that, then I think what follows next comes kind of naturally, is that you want to be careful what you say. Because a lot of harm gets created in society by our speech. And so if you want to practice from goodwill and compassion, then you want to be careful that you don't speak in unkind ways, in harmful ways to other people. And so the third step in the Eightfold Path is called right speech, caring for your speech. And so again, here it's interpersonal, because usually speech is mostly to other people. And it's such a core part of this Buddhist spirituality that you take care about how you live in relationship to the world around you. You don't just sit. Buddhism is not just about retreating from the world and sitting there meditating and your eyes closed, but it has a lot to do with how you want to live your life. If what you want to do is to use this path for its full potential, the fullest possible liberation that you can experience. So care about how you speak. The fourth step in the Eightfold Path is right action. Probably if you're interested in not causing harm with your speech, pretty soon you start getting interested in not causing harm in your actions either. And so how do you behave in such a way that you don't cause harm to others? How do you behave in such a way that your behavior expresses goodwill and compassion? And so the basic ideas here is you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't lie, and you don't engage in sexual misconduct. Those four, and then the last one is often included, is you don't engage in intoxication. You don't intoxicate yourself. Those four and those five cause a tremendous havoc and suffering in this world of ours. There's no shortage of people who later on will say, "What was I thinking? I wish I hadn't." Then from that, kind of, in a sense, if you want to be interested in how you behave and your actions in the world and how you relate to other people, then the, kind of the next, maybe the next natural step is your livelihood. Many people spend much of their life in livelihood. Livelihood is something that for many people affects many people beyond themselves. And so how to have a livelihood that doesn't cause harm? How to cause a livelihood, how to have a livelihood that's connected to this right intention thing? A livelihood that's connected to goodwill and to compassion. So with that, with those first five steps of the Eightfold Path, those then become the foundation for the last three. And at that point, you know, you're starting to take care of your life, you're starting to create better relationships with the world around you, you're interested in goodwill and compassion. Maybe it's not easy to have it, but at least you're interested in it. And that's a big change for many people, some people, to really, really take it seriously and be interested in it and cultivate it and develop it. And you're beginning to apply it in your life and doing the best you can. And to do this really well, it takes a lot of effort. It's not easy necessarily. But all this then leads you to become more interested in what goes on inside of you, in your mind or your heart. And so how do I... It's one thing to just speak kindly and have, you know, a job that doesn't cause harm in the world. But at some point you realize, you know, really the source of all this begins in my mind. The intentions of my mind, the idea, what I want to do, the impulses of my mind. And so at some point, this trajectory, the interest is to let me look at my mind. What am I doing there? So when you're standing in the Safeway line, being impatient, you feel how tense you are in your shoulders. You can certainly relax your shoulders, but you might also want to start looking at your mind. If your mind is spinning around, agitated, that feels painful. And so, or your mind is filled with hate for the person in front of you who, you know, can't find, you know, is paying with coins and can't find them all. And you know, and the bill is $75, and you're filled with not only you're irritated, but you realize after a while, it's one thing to wish that person well, but this really hurts, and so I think I need to begin taking some responsibility for my mind. And this is the sixth step of the Eightfold Path, which is right effort. And right effort means to make the effort to do the things with your mind that's healthy and avoid that which is unhealthy. To do the things in your mind that are helpful and avoid those things which are unhelpful. So greed and hate are not helpful. And so can you figure out how, can you track that to notice the clinging, the greed that you have, the hate that you have, the variety of things. And can you track it? Can you let go of it? Generosity, goodwill, compassion, are helpful things. Patience is helpful things. Virtue is a helpful thing. So there's a whole bunch of things that goes on inside that you want to start tracking. And it's a wonderful thing to start feeling you have some, not only can you monitor it so you don't do things that later you regret, but not only can you monitor it, but you have some ability to choose what your mind does. People who don't monitor their inner life, their mind, their thoughts, their feelings, their impulses, find themselves that they have no choice in their life and they do things they don't know why. This is a little, slightly aside, I guess, but I'm remembering that I went to San Quentin, and I go to San Quentin most years to bring a group of people to, people who are being trained to be Buddhist chaplains, to see chaplaincy in San Quentin. And we went to a violence prevention program, and they put us in this room full of people who, murderers, and did an awful thing, some of these people. And my experience of being in this room of people in this violent prevention program is I feel safest with them than almost any group of people I've ever been with, because of the, because of the inner work that they've done, how they've been transformed. These are transformed men by the time we get to see them. I mean, there are other people in San Quentin who are not transformed. And, you know, you don't want to be alone with them, but these people are quite something. And but one of the exercises they're given when they begin this program is they're asked, how long have you been here in San Quentin? Or how long have you been in? A little bit echoey. Can you turn it down a little bit? It's a little bit echoey. Is that a little bit better? Okay. So how long, you know, have you served in jail? I guess the state jail system, they move around. And they'll say, well, I've been here for 15 years, 25 years, you know, 10 years, you know. And they write it on a chalkboard, and they add them all up for the 20 guys who are there. And they have, you know, it's like 425 years, you know, they've been in jail. That's on one column. And then the next column, they say, how long was how long was the period of danger, the period in which they were in danger of doing the crime that brought them to San Quentin? So how long was their period of danger? And they would say, 30 seconds, 2 minutes. You know, actually, the period of danger was actually quite short. And then in the other column, they had, you know, how long that period of danger was. And, you know, I added it up to, you know, 20 guys, you know, I don't know what it added up to, but maybe an hour. An hour versus 425 years. So, impulse, you know, and not being able to monitor yourself, not seeing the choice that the people that you make, and the consequences that, you know, that lasts for so long. So the right effort has to do with starting to take some, you know, responsibility and looking well at what goes on in our minds. To be interested in our minds, our hearts, if you prefer that kind of language, requires mindfulness. And so then it comes natural, I think, to want to begin cultivating a greater sense of mindfulness, to pay more careful attention, intimate attention, to get to know oneself really well, to get know yourself in a way probably you've never known yourself before, to know the subtle movements of the mind, the subtle desires, the subtle feelings, the subtle intentions, the subtle beautiful, not so subtle, the beautiful qualities of who we are that are maybe overlooked and not tapped into so much. Mindfulness is a powerful tool both to help us see clearly some of the places of attachment that are quite subtle and tenacious, but also to see some of the most beautiful parts of the human heart that are great resources and great things that we can turn our life into gifts to people. So then comes mindfulness. With the growth of mindfulness, one of the things that people discover is it's kind of hard to stay focused. you know, to keep the focus, to look carefully and stay on track. And so then the interest becomes, how do I get more focused? How do I stabilize the mind? And that's the last of the Eightfold Path, which is right concentration. So right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. They kind of have a trajectory, they kind of like build on each other and kind of follow each other in some kind of natural order. With development of the stability of mind, then it's possible to see the Four Noble Truths and how they act out in their lives much more carefully. And so we're back at the beginning. So it's kind of a spiral that goes around and around. Until such a time that a person experiences the path in front of them without any obstacles. Until such a time that a person has an experience of their mind or their heart completely cleansed. Completely cleansed of obstacles or hindrances or what Buddhism sometimes calls defilements, the clinging that's there. And remarkable things begin to happen to people when they experience their life without any clinging whatsoever. It's not nihilism, it's not like the end of your life, but to know that that's a possibility and to know that so many things that we're holding on to for dear life are not needed, because the healthiest, happiest way of being in the world is without clinging. To feel that health, to feel that happiness and sense of well-being, that peace, and to know absolutely that having that peace required letting go of clinging. That's what it took. It didn't take, you know, having or reorganizing the world just to your liking, and having something in the world just work just perfectly so that you can be happy. The world can do what it wants to do, or what it needs to do, what happens in the world. But finding the Eightfold Path and that freedom is the portable way in any situation you find yourself to see the freedom, to see the path, to see the way forward, so that you can be free, so that you can be peaceful, so that your heart can be available to the world in an unobstructed way. The Eightfold Path is a really beautiful, beautiful thing. And for some people, as I said, this becomes the primary meaning, purpose, orientation of their life. It's what gives meaning to their life to do this. And some people might say, well, that can't be, that's kind of selfish, isn't it? You know, because it seems like I'm freeing myself of suffering. One of the best things that we can do for others is to help them become free of suffering, to become to have that kind of happiness. But if you don't know what that's like, how are you going to teach it to someone else? How are you going to share it to someone else? Someone has to, you know how to do it. So that's what the Eightfold Path are for. So that's the general introduction. And the plan I have is then for the next 8 weeks that I'm here to go through each one of those eight factors in a slower, careful way, and see if we can make each of those factors come alive for you and be meaningful for you. And you can maybe see each factor as how it applies in your life and the value you might want to have for the eighth path factor, how you want to incorporate it and find it useful for you. And then if you want to, if you want to come to these Dharma practice days we have on Friday, that's another place where we'll kind of explore these more deeply. Okay? So thank you.